on judiciary to order. We have work sessions today on three bills. The first one we're going to start with will be Senate Bill 1094. So I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1094. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the dash three amendments in front of you. They come from Senator Winters. They are different from the bill that you have before you. Going on to page one of the bill, they basically, of the original bill, says a police officer is defined shall confiscate. The shall has been changed to a may. And then it goes further on to page five, and it removes all those provisions thereafter. Otherwise, it also references in the draft ORS 807.010 and 811.182 rather than 111.175, and I believe that has differences as it relates to some penalties. The dash three amendments also have they become operative January 1, 2011.
Okay.
And as you know, this bill relates to the issue of driving while suspended. You heard testimony the last time concerning the placement of stickers on license plates and confiscation of the registration card and all the matters like that.
All right, it's my understanding on the dash threes, basically what we have done is remove part of the original bill that dealt with creating, let's say, new crimes where some that were violations that would be elevated to criminal. Those things have come out, correct?
I believe so.
Senator Winters, I don't know if you want to put anything on the record or not.
We're fine with moving forward.
Okay. So, colleagues, this time for a discussion on Senate Bill 1094, specifically the dash threes as a substitute based on the discussion we've had. Is there any other comments? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendment to the Senate Bill 1094.
Senator Wissett has moved the dash threes for Senate Bill 1094. Are there any discussion?
Yes.
Yes.
I had to leave early for another reason last time we dealt with this, and so I didn't get to ask the question, but I have to tell you, I'm a little bit concerned about sticking stickers on vehicles that others may use, because this appears that an officer may stop that vehicle for the sole reason of saying there's a sticker on there that says the person who owns this vehicle is not allowed to drive it.
That's correct. This actually, if I remember correctly, when we had the zebra plate program previously in the 90s, grants the same authority that they had then. It is, in effect, a basis for a stopping a vehicle for the sole reason for the officer to determine whether or not the person who is driving the vehicle is suspended. We have to realize that not only could it be the registered owner driving the vehicle, but it could be someone else. That provision also states that if the officer determines, let's say there's some other activity, offense that is created or has occurred during that investigation as to whether or not the person is suspended, they would be able to move forward on those charges that could come to light to the officer during that time. So it is another means for stopping a vehicle, but that's what the zebra program did before. And so basically we're trying to reinstitute at this point the program as a means to deal with individuals who are in fact driving suspended, whether they are the registered owner or the user of the vehicle. And the provisions are set forth as to what the steps the officer would take based on the discovery of one of those components for this measure. Any other questions?
Well, I'm reading about it, and I read it before, and I was concerned about it. The study from 1997 said that the zebra program may have resulted in a general deterrent effect. Didn't say that it did. It also showed that 44% of the cases show the driver was not the owner of the vehicle. So I don't understand. Would you be stickering a vehicle the driver didn't own? Only a vehicle the driver who's been cited. A vehicle that the driver owns.
Yeah, my understanding that council questions come up whether or not in the placement of a zebra sticker, is that limited to only the vehicle that is owned or co-owned by the driver who is suspended as compared to someone that's borrowing the vehicle?
Mm-hmm. Chairman of the committee, I believe you have to be the owner and the operator.
At the time of the zebra sticker.
So if it's a husband and a wife who own it, and let's pick on the husband. The husband gets the DUII or gets his license suspended for whatever reason, and then the wife drives the car. It'll still be stickered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's correct.
But she's female.
And well, the question would be really at the next point, if the officer in a second contact observed a female driving a vehicle that's registered to a male who is license has been suspended, whether or not they had the right to stop the vehicle. And the way the statute or the way the measure's written, I believe that they would still have the right to stop them to determine whether or not the operator of the vehicle at the time that they're operating it were suspended or not.
Mm-hmm.
If they determine that that was not the case, that should conclude their contact with the individual unless there was something else that occurred during that contact that could raise to a level of probable cause for another offense being committed.
And if the person buys another vehicle, Mr. Chair, it will be properly stickered or not?
When you say properly stickered,
well, if they go to buy another vehicle and then register it, is it flagged in their DMV record that their license is suspended and they therefore get a sticker placed on their license plate? I don't see that in here. I'm missing it.
Yeah, I didn't remember seeing that in the original draft. That if you had some, Senator, come on forward. My understanding is that that in itself wouldn't automatically occur on the new vehicle. That they would automatically...
Well, no, because the person wouldn't have a valid driver's license in order to get the new vehicle in the first place. So that's moot. And I want to go back to the question that you raised. If you look at page 3, section 4, your comment about the other driver, and if the driver was not an owner of the vehicle at the time the registered plates were marked under Section 2 of this Act, the department shall promptly notify the registered owner by first class mail at the address shown on the record. The department may not cancel the registration of the vehicle.
Okay. Senator Winters, you can get a registration for a vehicle without being a licensed driver. You don't have to have a driver's license to register a vehicle.
That's unfortunate.
Well, it's unfortunate in the sense that if someone goes out and buys a new vehicle and registers it, that sticker's not going to necessarily follow them unless it's flagged.
Well, we have until, if you notice the start date, Motor Vehicles asked for 2011 to give them time to really flesh out some of these questions that you're raising.
Yeah. Okay. And at this point, if we adopt the -3s, the next motion would be to refer it to Ways and Means, which is a subsequent referral requirement, so there may be some other time to look at other things we may want to do during this cycle. If not, then the 09 cycle would open up the other opportunity to maybe tighten down some of those concerns.
as I understand, because of the date of 2011, that it is not required for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The agency specifically asked for that date to give them time with which to do their due diligence. So, in fact, they're here if you want them to.
Yeah, but Senator Winters, the thing, I had counsel check, and that
not accurate.
Has not been rescinded by the president's office, and so I have to go where they tell me I have to go on that. So apparently that was not, nothing's been changed from the original referrals. Any other questions, Senator Walker?
No, that answers my questions. And I could be wrong, but I'm almost certain you can register a vehicle without a driver's license. A lot of folks have registered vehicles that are...
I can assure you, based on the nods from the DMV, you are correct.
I'm correct? Good.
She usually is.
Don't like being wrong, but I'll admit it if I am. Okay.
Senator, what's it?
Just a comment. The studies that were done before would show that the rate of moving violations were down about 13% and crashes were down about 11% on those vehicles that were stickered. Given that this is much more narrowly focused on the on those people who are much more likely to be impaired when they drive than the law was, I would think that common sense would indicate that those percentages would probably go up. So I think that it was a very effective means of reducing people driving while suspended and thereby causing more accidents and more grief to the people.
Right.
So it's you have to do a little interpretation of the data, but it. It would certainly seem to me that as this bill is more focused on the, if you will, the worst of the worst, then the results should be much better.
Yep. Mr. Chair, can I make just a quick comment? You know that this was a result of the death of a 77-year-old. I understand that there's been other deaths on the highway of individuals driving not only without a license but unlicensed. And I noted that it's kind of interesting when we talked about the zebra sticker that I just received some communication that Washington is probably going one step further. They're talking about fluorescent yellow license plates for certain offenses, particularly the DUI-related crimes. So this is an issue that's serious, I hope that we move forward. If we have one death, two deaths, that's two deaths too many.
Yeah. Senator Winters, it's the Chair's position, we are going to move the bill today. I think we have the votes for it. And I do want to say, as much as we would like this would stop fatalities for those who are driving while suspended, it probably won't, but it will, in fact, probably catch some people and make it more inconvenient for them to be able to access vehicles. And we'll see where it goes.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say I remember my first session, I think it was, Lars Larson wanted to put some kind of sticker on driver's licenses if you'd been convicted of drunk driving. So I hope this doesn't start a trend that we start putting stickers on driver's licenses. I understand, or on license plates. I understand where you're going here, Senator Winters, and I appreciate it. But I also want to tell you that if you're concerned about unlicensed and unregistered drivers, the bill we just passed on the Senate floor yesterday will even add to that further.
All right. Any other comments and discussion? Any objections to the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 1094? Not seeing or hearing any, so ordered. And Senator Wissett, I think the appropriate motion would be send it to the subsequent referral to Ways and Means as we originally were charted to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move Senate Bill 1094. To the Ways and Means Committee with a pass recommendation.
As amended by the Dash 3s?
As amended by the Dash 3s.
We've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1094, and we're going to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 1095. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Committee, you have before you the Dash 2 amendments. I believe they supersede the Dash 1 and they replace the bill, and it sets forth a process and procedure for bail for people basically charged with possession of methamphetamines or manufactured delivery methamphetamines within school or manufactured delivery period, and also commercial drug transactions. I have a fiscal impact statement that's wasn't supposed to be numbered. I just got up there and just found it. As it relates to the original bill, I think the most telling thing in here is that this bill does not affect local government service levels or share revenue sufficient enough to trigger Section 15, Article 11 of the Oregon Constitution. That would be the supermajority.
Okay. So we have the dash twos and also the dash ones.
I believe the dash two supersede the dash one, but Senator Woods could probably shed more light on that than I can.
Yes, the dash two is a complete amendment.
Okay, Senator Wissett, since you had a mini work group regarding tightening this up and addressing maybe some of the concerns that we had during the last hearing, is there anything else you'd like to add on the dash twos?
Mr. Chair, I think we pretty well addressed all of those concerns. We made it very clear that the person accused has the right to a hearing on excessive bail. We made it very clear that the result of that hearing would allow a downward departure of the bail to as low as $50,000. There's also a feature that if the person who is out on bail violates that security agreement by committing another crime during that period, then there would be a $500,000 minimum bail. If they violate the provision without creating a crime, it would an additional new crime, it would be a $250,000 minimum bail. It's designed to try to take the worst offenders off the street and keep them from causing damage and danger to the public during the time of their waiting trial.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion regarding the Dash 2 amendments for Senate Bill 1095?
Mr. Chair, I just have one question. I'm sorry I didn't hear Mr. Taylor. He may have responded to this. The fiscal statement says Oregon Justice Department also has some concerns about the constitutionality of the bill with respect to excessive bail. Mm-hmm. Did you respond to that and I wasn't listening?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
it is what it is.
I responded to them concerning that. They said they'd raise concerns. I have not seen any opinion from them. I mean, they did not contact me concerning that issue.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is coming from LFO. Department of Justice does not anticipate a fiscal impact due to this bill. OJD, Oregon Judicial Department, has also had concerns about the constitutionality of the bill with respect to excessive bail. I have to admit, in the whole time here, it's the first time I've ever had the Judicial Department express concerns about constitutionality of the bill in a fiscal impact statement.
It's an odd place to see it. and then, of course, there's the paragraph about the substantive fiscal effect on local jails if defendants cannot generate the minimum security release amount.
Yes.
One of the things, Senator Walker, that I did not mention is the last section of the Section 8 of the Dash 2 amendment states that nothing in this section affects the ability of a county court or board of commissioners or a county to adopt or implement a jail capacity limit and action plan under Arrest Force 169. Those are basically, it preserves the local jurisdiction's ability to matrix out people according to the capacity of the jail.
Okay, so if they don't have capacity in their jail,
then they can still incarcerate the worst of the worst, and they don't have to put someone in jail.
Okay. All right. Good work.
All right. Any other questions? Any objection to the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 1095? Not seeing or hearing any. So ordered. And we'll take a motion to move this one to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 1095 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
As
including the Dash 2 amendment.
Excellent. Senator Wissett has moved the Senate Bill 1095 as amended by the Dash 2 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Wissett, you'll be the carrier on this one.
Thank you.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1095. And at this time, the Senate Judiciary is going to be taking a recess. I'm going to set the recess that we'll come back at 2:30. We have some drafting that needs to be completed and reviewed, and hopefully we'll have it then. But I'm going to give everyone fair warning. We may not be ready at 2:30. It may mean that we have to come back after our designated time, which ends at 3, to make certain we have the language that we want and need to move forward. As everyone realizes from our timeline that we have for our measures, today is the last day for us to be moving bills out of this committee that are started on the Senate side. And so it's the chair's intent to do that, hopefully sooner than later, but we'll do our best. So we'll stand in recess until 2:30 with the understanding that we may be coming back in and extending the recess out. Until 2:30 is 2:35. We are in the process of doing some drafting that needs to be completed, and so we're going to stay in recess until 6 p.m., and I believe we will be moving into Hearing Room D. Hearing Room D. So we'll stay in recess until 6 p.m. reconvene, I should say. The Senate Judiciary Committee, we've been in recess waiting on some drafting that needed to be done on Senate Bill 1087. We now have that before us, so I will open a work session on Senate Bill 1087. And, Bill, why don't you walk us through
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 8 amendment stated 212.08. The first section is the finding. As you know, this is a referral to the voters. It's pretty self-explanatory. The second section is legislative finding. Section 2 is drug trafficking penalty. Section 3 is drug delivery to minors penalty. Section 4 is aggravated theft over $10,000 to victim over 65. Section 5 is drug definition. Section 6 is repeat drug dealer. Section 7 is repeat property offender. Section 8 is treatment grants for drug addicted offenders. The Department of Corrections treatment programs, county jails, county treatment programs, county intensive supervision, CJC drug courts, Criminal Justice Commission drug courts. Section 9, swift and certain sanctions for refusal to participate in treatment. Section 10, mail theft enhanced to C felony. Section 11, limitations and downward departures for drug trafficking, delivery to minors, aggravated theft over 65. Section 12, sentencing provisions apply to crimes committed after 1109. Treatment provisions effective 1709. Section 13, this is the either-or clause as it relates to Initiative Petition 40. And Section 14, referral to the 1108 ballot.
All right. So I guess the chair wants to just put a few things on the record here. We've had a work group made up of individuals and stakeholders. This has been an ongoing process, and it's one that we've reached a consensus and conclusion as to what we believe is best at this point to move forward, a better way in combating the property crimes that have faced our state and many of our citizens. With that, we've had a lot of negotiations with different key players of the program, and to making certain that we were covering the bases that needed to be covered and having a balanced approach that would be comprehensive, cost-effective, and dealing with not only holding the people accountable for their crimes, but also giving the opportunity for them to actually go through a drug treatment program to combat continued, recidivism in these areas. And Chair is very pleased that we got as many people here tonight and on board as to working forward for what we believe is best for the state, with the understanding that one of the things that we will have is what I refer to as the carrot and stick, specifically that we'll have where individuals that are being convicted of these crimes that have been assessed to be high risk or medium risk and for need for drug treatment, that if those dollars are available, that they will in fact be in those programs. And if they fail or refuse to do those programs, the stick will be a lengthier sentence for their failure to complete or to participate in those. This is one of the areas I think that for our state will be somewhat different than what we've done in the past. We are looking at having a significant amount of money that will be used both inside the state system as well as through a grant process for the locals, and making certain that we do address these issues for these offenders that we have been able to identify that are, say, causing the most havoc, holding them accountable, but at the same time attempting to break them out of the cycle with effective drug treatment programs. The other part, as counsel has mentioned, is that there will be a requirement that there be review of these various programs to make certain they are effective and that they are, in fact, producing the results that we want. So with that, I'd like to invite some of the stakeholders that have been at the table negotiating and participating, giving us their insight. And so I will start off, I think, with Oregon District Attorneys Association, if that's all right.
Chair Pruszanski, members of the committee, my name is John Foote, and I serve as a Clackamas County District Attorney. I'm here as a member of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we are very pleased that we've been able to work something out that we think is cost-effective and does the things we think have to be done to deal with property crime, repeat property crime in the state. As you, as everyone knows, the DAs have, from the beginning have been very concerned that there be increased punishments for people who persist in chronic property crime, and we think this bill and this proposal carries those consequences in a way that we think we can work with them and make them and protect citizens and reduce the number of victims, we hope, and certainly hold offenders accountable. So we feel that that goal has been reached with this proposal, and we support it. We also recognize that there's an interest in doing treatment that's effective, and we think there are going to be components in this that will make that work as well. It's in another bill, but we believe that. And there's also language in here about treatment. So we want treatment that works and changes behavior, as does everyone else. And we think there's an opportunity here. We have a lot of thank yous. And you know, whenever you start that, you miss people. And so my apologies. And a lot of this I'll do when I'm not sitting up here, but so many people have been involved in these conversations, from the chair, yourself, to other members of the legislature on both sides of the aisle, to the governor's office. And without everyone's participation, I just do not believe we'd be here. And although Kevin Mannix has simply chosen not to be involved at this point, we owe him a thank you, and I would be remiss if I didn't say it. And we said that to him privately, and I'd say it publicly. So sometimes people just part ways for their own purposes, and that's as it should be. So I'd be glad to answer any questions. I'm really here to say that the ODA supports this bill.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
And you mentioned Kevin Mannix. Could you contrast, since this is going to be a competing measure now with Kevin Mannix's bill, what's the difference between the Dash 8s and Kevin Mannix's bill? Just the major points. I know one's one strike you're out, one two strike you're out, that sort of thing.
Well, Senator Sherrod, members of the committee, that's a long conversation, but I think it's fair to say that everyone was concerned about the cost of Measure 40 and its impact on other parts of government. And as citizens, we all share that responsibility. DAs were looking for a way to really get some teeth in the law that preserved judicial discretion, although controlled, allowed for treatment. We think this is the right approach. There'll be plenty of opportunity to contrast the proposals as time goes on. I can't do it here tonight very adequately, but I think this bill carries the kind of things that we think are the right approach. So I don't mean to duck the question. It's just a long answer.
Okay. Can I ask one just a quick follow-up? Right. The ballot title, do you know who, maybe the chair knows that, who's going to write the ballot title for this bill?
I will be answering that question. We, the legislature, will be putting together the ballot title. We expect that it will be one that will, one, be voted on by the legislature. It will provide for the normal redress and recourse for individuals who choose to challenge it. It will be open through that process and can be taken to the courts if they deem that the ballot title does not reflect what the measure has. And it's my position on these type of measures, just as we saw in 1999, where there was a victim's rights measure that had to be broken out. We, the legislature, wrote all of the ballot titles for each and every one of those and then sent them out, and they were, let's say, open for review and for challenge.
Okay. Chair, if I could add one thing. A couple of the thank yous. I want to specifically thank Crime Victims United. They've been very involved in this process. I don't know where they are on the bill, but I know that they support much of what's in it, and I want to personally thank them. And also, they're a cross-section of people. They're defense attorneys who've been very involved in the conversation. Partnership for Safety and Justice has been involved. Although those folks will make their own decisions about this proposal, but I think it's appropriate to thank them because I think everyone's tried to find common ground here. So.
Thank you. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Posnanski. Mr. Foote, I, too, appreciate the effort and I support a lot of the parts of this bill. Draw your attention to Section 8. The Department of Corrections shall provide appropriate treatment services to drug addicted persons from the custody of the department who are at a high risk for medium risk of offending. and who have a moderate to severe treatment needs. This appears to be a mandate that all those who are incarcerated who have a high or medium risk of reoffending and have a higher risk of substance abuse. I think that's one of the tiebreakers for me, in that it seems to me that the alcohol and drug abuse is not a right of the accused. It is the right of the corrections department to decide who is going to administer the, you know, who is capable of being rehabilitated, who is should receive those treatments, how often they should receive those treatments. This particular statement is an open-ended check, so to speak, and it's my understanding, if this is put in and referred to the people and is passed by the people, it would take a two-thirds majority of the of both chambers in order to change that. Is that correct?
Well, Senator Witz, members of the committee, I'm not an expert on, and I can't answer that right now, but my read of this is it's not a sentence. It's a treatment component, and therefore it doesn't, that's subject to Measure 10, but that's just a real high altitude look at it. And I want to say that I fundamentally agree with your point, that this doesn't create a right. It creates a responsibility on part of the department. And I think the provision itself, if you go on to the next page, has two provisions in it that make that clear in our mind. And this is the way we see it. Number one, on Section 4, it specifically says it creates no right or claim. And the idea that a defendant would have a right or claim to complain about not getting treatment, I think, is curious anyway. But this specifically, in my mind, takes it away. And number two, it makes it clear that the decision about treatment at the time of sentencing is the court's discretion, no one else's. What happens after that is the responsibility of the Department of Corrections, if they're given to the Department of Corrections. So that's how we see it. I know that others have been concerned about it, and we asked for some language to make that clear. So I don't think it creates a right. I think it creates a responsibility in the department. No right of the defendant to the treatment. That's the way I see it.
Thank you.
And I'll follow up on that. John, I agree with you. That was one of the areas we did discuss, and as he stated, when you look on page 10, lines 13 through 16, does provide, let's say, more clarity. And also, just for the information of the committee, the process that will be used is one that's already used by DOC, that when someone comes into their facility, I believe they take about a 30-day period to do assessment, testing, and risk decisions on the individual as to what their needs are and how it would be best to try to, let's say, steer them into various programs and what their actual needs are. And through that process, they will prioritize those that are high or medium risk and offenders, and also the dependency. Clearly, the money, if it's there, we expect that it will, in fact, be used that way. But we believe that the record is being set even tonight, that this does not provide, quote-unquote, a right to the defendant, but as John has said, more of an obligation as to what the department should do. There's cross-checks in here requiring also that the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission do certain tasks, including that they periodically conduct independent evaluations of the programs to make certain that they are effective in reducing the criminal behavior in a cost-effective manner.
Mr. Chair, it would seem to me that lack of clarity could certainly be changed by simply changing the word shall. And I believe that word shall was a hang-up from Senator Beyer way back early in the process before I came into the work group process, and I'm conferring with him this afternoon. He was concerned, and my work group was alarmed that it was back in there.
Well, it's been in there. I don't believe it's ever been taken out. I do believe Senator Beyer did raise that as a concern, as something he wanted to be looked at. We did look at it, and what we determined was that by changing that such as to a discretionary word such as may would give the department maybe more flexibility than what we, the legislature, believe is a shift in policy and need to make certain that these individuals go through there. Plus, If you speak with your own county local corrections individuals, I think you'd find from them some of the concerns they raised with us is that they want to make certain that the money that is being set aside for this type of programs are in fact going to be coming to the local area so they can actually utilize that money for the felons that are within their jurisdiction and their facilities that were under the basically the 1145 population. And so this is a means that we can assure that those local corrections officers and facilities will be able to receive a portion of the revenue that will be going through this process for treatment services as well as for the bed space to hold these individuals accountable if they turn out to refuse treatment or if they should have a sanction needing to be applied because they, let's say, had a positive urine test, such as that on a drug treatment program. And let's see, I guess the other thing, is there any other questions for John? Senator Walker.
Thank you. On the carrying on with the discussion we were just having about shall, I think when you were asked the question, what was the difference between what we're proposing and what Mannix is proposing, I think the difference is in the treatment. That's not even a component of IP 40. And I think without the shall in here, you would find people not supportive of this measure because wouldn't you agree, Mr. Foote, that 85, as the Department of Corrections says, 85% of repeat property offenders within its custody have a moderate to severe drug and or alcohol problem. Wouldn't you see that as you're prosecuting these people?
Chair, Senator Walker, I don't know what the number is.
But it's
I know
pretty
a lot
darn
of
high.
It's a lot. And one of the challenges for us is to set, and we've had this discussion endlessly, is to separate criminal behavior from behavior involving drugs or alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very difficult distinction. We want to make sure that those two things get separated, and we think that this bill gives us a real good chance to separate those two things.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, I'm going to follow up if you don't mind. The recidivism rate is pretty high among these groups of people too. The department will tell you it's about 49%, and we're trying to bring that number down, and we show that with treatment we can do that because it's better than building brick-and-mortar prisons and sticking people in there, and then they come back out in the community, and nothing has changed. The behavior's not changed. The addiction's probably still there. And I would point you to Section 9 of the bill on page 10 that clearly indicates that if you've been put into a drug or alcohol treatment program and you violate the terms of that program, there will be swift and certain punishment, including incarceration. And I believe that that's probably of comfort to you as a district attorney in your association. Is that not correct?
Senator Walker, yes. We think that's a good provision. We think one of the strengths of this proposal is it closes the bridge and doesn't set treatment against accountability. Mm-hmm. We don't see them as an either-or proposition. We think, as prosecutors, the fundamental thing that has to happen to property offenders is they have to be held accountable. And that means prison sentences if they don't change their behavior. Mm-hmm. The current system simply doesn't do that. It requires a fifth felony conviction before you're even eligible to go to prison. We think this bill has directly addressed that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first piece. We also think that treatment that works is something we ought to do, but we ought to make sure that it's spent wisely and we do it on things that make a difference. And that's why there's a provision in the bill for independent evaluations. That's something very important to us, and we're going to continue to have those conversations with everyone involved in that because we really believe that the quality of those evaluations has to be high so that we know that this really makes a difference. We're concerned that there are a lot of treatment programs that haven't been evaluated properly. So we think this bill can address that.
Mm-hmm.
It's all in the doing later, but we think this bill sets the stage for that to happen.
Okay, and my last comment, Mr. Chair, is just an interesting side note, which has been pointed out before, that the data is showing that property crime and addiction is significantly increasing among females. And that is a growing population element of our prisons, and those females leave behind generally children and families, as do the males. But we just see that among females, they get caught up in the manufacturing process. They go out and do the stealing and hustling the money. It's kind of a sad situation that we have in our state, and I'm sure it's repeated in every other state. So that's why the treatment is also important to change the behavior.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And I just want to follow up on Senator Garrod. You asked some questions as to the differences between the two. I'll just focus on two or three that I can give you. On IP40, it requires mandatory minimum sentencing for first-time drug offenders and certain property crimes. Does not allow for any type of downward departure in those sentences. There is no funding, as Senator Walker says, for drug courts or for treatment of those individuals while they are in custody. And the estimated cost on a biennium basis ranges somewhere between $250 million to $400 million. On the flip side of the legislative proposal, we do increase the sentencing for certain property crimes committed by these individuals. Enhanced sentences for offenders who are convicted of manufacturing, delivering, trafficking in large quantities of drugs, which IP40 did not have. Also provides for the grants that we've talked to for counties for jail beds, treatment, drug courts, intensive supervision. And the cost for that is somewhere in the range of $140 million on a biennium basis. And we're anticipating $40 million of that to be reserved for the treatment at both at the DOC level as well as the local level, which also would support the enhanced bed and jail space needed for those individuals who need to be sanctioned because they're out of compliance.
Mr. Chair, now that you mentioned the treatment dollars, I would like to ask a question about that, and I don't think it's a question of Mr. Foote.
We're going to have a couple other people here, I think, maybe
okay.
On treatment. It probably would be maybe the governor's office.
Okay, that would be appropriate. Okay.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's see, I'm going to go ahead and ask Joe O'Leary to come up. And while he's doing that, I also want to thank everyone that's been part of the work group. We started out for the committee when we had our first two meetings, we had close to 30-plus people showing up with various interests, public sector, private sector. And through that process, we narrowed the group down to first just legislators, and then we brought in various components of the larger group so we could actually continue to work through the issues that we had. And I also want to thank ODAA, Crime Victims United, the Criminal Defense Bar, and the Partnership for Justice and
Safety
and Justice. I know that there were meetings that went on outside of this building over one of the weekends to help try to orchestrate through some of the differences that various groups brought in to bring us to a consensus tonight. Mr. O'Leary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe O'Leary, Governor Kulongoski's public safety advisor. It's a pleasure to be before you this evening. Mr. Foote did a very good job answering all of your tough questions. I hope I can.
Well, I'm going to ask you the money one. I think that's the toughest.
And let me ask you, Mr. O'Leary, would you like to have Mr. Prince come up?
If the chair is going to ask, if the members of the committee are going to ask me money questions, it may as well, we may as well have Craig come join me at the table.
Just in case.
Mr. Chair, I think I made a few notes, if I may, as to Senator Garrod's question about the contrast between this proposed referral and Senate Bill 1087 and IP40. And I think you mentioned already the first-timers versus repeat offenders and the more surgical focus of Senate Bill 1087 and the focus on repeat offenders as opposed to first-timers. Senator Walker pointed out the treatment component versus no treatment component. There's also a significant difference insofar as the types of offenses that are addressed in Senate Bill 1087. Unlike IP40, Senate Bill 1087 creates the offense of drug trafficking of substantial quantities of methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, and ecstasy. And what we did with the input from the Oregon Department of Justice was we took the threshold that is right now the substantial quantity maximum threshold under Oregon law that's typically about 10 grams, depending on the substance. For meth, for example, it's 10 grams. And we looked at what the federal government does as far as taking trafficking cases. And what we saw was they, for the most part, the U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't really touch a case unless it's about a pound, which is 500 grams. And what we did was we wanted to fill the void between 10 grams and 500 grams with appropriately enhanced sentences when you step up to an amount that does not exceed 100 grams, and then further when you step up to an amount that exceeds 500 grams. So it is in this way that that we are offering to provide Oregon's law enforcement community the tools it needs to crack down on drug traffickers that are bringing methamphetamine and other controlled substances into our state over our interstate highway system. This is a really important contrast. It's a very important element of this legislation. And it dovetails wonderfully with what the legislature did in 2005 in its landmark methamphetamine legislation restricting pseudoephedrine. You all know this, but the restrictions on pseudoephedrine that you put into place have virtually eliminated home meth labs in the state of Oregon. Virtually eliminated. The only meth labs they're finding now are dump sites. It's incredible. That doesn't mean, as you all know from your communities, that doesn't mean meth use has gone away. It is still around, and we, through our friends in law enforcement, know that meth is coming in by traffickers who are bringing it in from out of state. Much of it is being produced now in super labs in Mexico, and we need to provide our law enforcement in this state with the tools they need to hold those traffickers accountable. It will also, I would submit, dovetail very nicely with the enhancement to the Oregon State Police patrol that I know is also under consideration in this supplemental session. That's the drug trafficking piece. The other piece that is a contrast substantively is the piece that has to do with aggravated theft of over $10,000 from a victim over 65. And this, again, was intended. This is largely from our constituents in law enforcement, and prosecutors tell us that this is largely an offense that is perpetrated by drug addicts, and the crimes against vulnerable persons should be in a different category. And that's why the enhanced sentences that 1087 makes available with limited opportunity for downward departure, I might add, by the court, are in there. The other thing that is very significant is the repeat property offender expansion. And that, as explained previously, has unchanged from the prior draft. The 13-month current sentences for the lower echelon property crimes are enhanced to 18 months, and the current 19-month higher echelon of property crimes will be enhanced to 24 months. What we also do in this is accelerate the period of time in which repeat property offenders are eligible for those presumptive prison sentences. Under current law, for the lower echelon cases, you don't go to prison until you get 5 predicate offenses. Under 1087, you will go to prison on, and this is what we spent much of the day talking about, so I hope I get it right in my testimony, but it's right in the language of the bill, I promise. But you will go to prison on your second offense if it is within 3 years of the termination of your supervision from your last predicate conviction. If it's a third offense, you go to prison no matter what. So that is a substantial acceleration from current law. We think it is surgical and smart, where it does not trap the first-time offender, but it does trap the second-time offender who has not taken the opportunity that we hope this bill gives them in other sections to take advantage of drug and alcohol treatment and change their behavior.
Senator Graham?
I know when I talked with Kevin Mannix, he was a little bit concerned about the language that was in the 3 year, I think he was actually thinking it was 5 year, that you could have an aggravated assault and a burglary, and the person spends 5 years in prison and then comes out and is a repeat offender, and then this wouldn't kick in. So has that been addressed in these amendments or not?
Senator Prezanski, Senator Garrod, it has. And the way it has been addressed is that instead of a straight five-year window from the prior conviction, what we are doing in the dash 8 to 1087 is saying that you have a three-year window from the termination of being on supervision. So in the example that you just gave, the person who goes to prison for, say, an assault and a related property crime that constitutes the predicate property offense gets out of prison and is on post-prison supervision for a period of time. And if they commit that second property offense within 3 years of the end of their post-prison supervision date, so they're out of prison, 3 years, they're flying straight, they terminate supervision within 3 years of that date of termination, is the window in which if they are convicted of a, excuse me, if they commit a new offense that is a repeat property offense, they will be subject to the presumptive prison sentence of 18 or 24 months.
Is Senator Burdick
still
on? Yeah. Senator Burdick?
Yes?
Just making sure we heard a beep from the phone. And
I was trying to get my phone on speaker, and it didn't work.
Okay, that's kind of right.
Senator, if I may, the last contrast that I just wanted to mention is a financial one. We're, to my mind, this is not about the money. This is about effective public safety policy. But the money is important. The annual cost, according to the Criminal Justice Commission of IP40, could be as much as $128 to $200 million a biennia. That does not include the cost of new prison, excuse me, I just...
Per year.
Per year, thank you. $128 to $200 per year, annual cost. That does not include the cost of prison construction. That is only the operational cost of DOC. That's not any treatment money either. To contrast, the annual cost of Senate Bill 1087 is, and based on the Dash 8 amendments, these are still rough numbers, but our best estimate right now is about $65 to $70 million per year. That does include both the additional prison beds as a result of the enhanced sentences and the enhanced treatment provisions.
Other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that last bit of information that Mr. O'Leary shared with us is really the shining example of why this is a better idea, because we get more bang for our buck here. We're not putting all of our money into constructing prisons. We are actually trying to be very effective with how we spend it, and we're not doing it on the cheap. I'm not getting the sense here this is being done on the cheap, that it is cost-effective, but the value that we get is just substantially more. Would you agree?
Chair Prezanski, Senator Walker, I would.
Okay.
I think we have hit the sweet spot between enhanced accountability and enhanced treatment opportunity. The governor firmly believes that we cannot incarcerate our way to public safety alone. And as District Attorney Foote pointed out a few moments ago, treatment and accountability is not an either or.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the perfect articulation of that point.
Yep.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Prezanski. Joe, is this estimate of cost, does this come from LFO or does this come from CJC? And the second question, is part of the question, is how do you put a fiscal analysis on an open-ended policy?
Senator Prezanski, Senator Wittsit, your first question is easier than your second, so I'll take that one. It came from the Criminal Justice Commission, and Craig can walk you through some of the details. And as to your second question, we have made every effort we can to craft limitations, appropriate limitations, while still keeping the element that I believe and the governor believes that we need of requiring drug and alcohol treatment for high-risk offenders who are addicts. The safeguards that we put were mentioned by District Attorney Foote, the hold harmless clause in Senate Bill 1087. There is also implementing language, which you have not seen yet. It was in an earlier version. Actually, I think the amendment that was before you earlier this week, and we took that implementing language out, and what we're going to be doing is putting that into a companion bill, which will be House Bill 3638, which will be heard in the House Judiciary Committee this Friday at 10 a.m. That bill will have the alternative incarceration program reforms that are all part of this package, the criminal history check measures, and the restrictions on felons voting in jail. And it will also have this implementing language around the treatment dollars that essentially, if I can summarize, essentially requires the Department of Corrections to gather an advisory committee, much like it does under the Community Corrections Act, of community corrections directors, commissioners. We want to add district attorneys and others in the public safety spectrum to evaluate the requests of counties to utilize the dollars that are appropriated by the legislature. It's going to be the legislature's call as to how much to appropriate on an ongoing basis. We, our understanding is that the desire here is to dedicate $20 million a year for this purpose. And we didn't pull that number out of the air. We pulled that number after consulting with Department of Corrections and the community corrections directors as a good substantial amount that would meet a need that there actually is both in prison, behind the walls, and in the community. And this advisory committee will make recommendations based on the amount that future legislatures appropriate for this purpose.
Thank you. Question for you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Will this, when this passes out of committee today, will this go to Ways and Means and then to a policy committee, Judiciary and House Committee? What is the course?
I don't know what the course is. Once it goes to Ways and Means, it will go to Ways and Means, and I guess the people above my pay scale will decide. It will first go to the floor on the Senate side, and then it will go to the House side, and the Speaker will have a determination to make at that point where it will or won't go.
So you do not know, or you can't answer the question whether this bill will ever see a policy committee on the House side, or whether the HB 3638 will ever see a policy and will ever see this committee.
All I can say is we're bicameral process. I can only speak for what I know what happens on the Senate side, what they do on the House side. At this point, I don't have any control over the Speaker as to what he may decide to do. I've had no conversations with him as to what his intention is toward this bill, and I have not had any discussions with the President regarding House Bill 3638 as to how it may come across. I'm assuming, knowing that 3638 will have financial implications, that will also need to be referred to Ways and Means, and I'm assuming in the normal course that it would follow, go through the Ways and Means process on the House side before it goes to the floor of the House, and then when it comes over, the President will be making those same decisions. So what we do know is that we're attempting to load everything up together so they can simultaneously move. And because that was part of the desire of all the people in the work group, is to make certain that simultaneously each side was moving the two pieces of legislation, because we believe those are important to have them moving consistently through this process.
So in short, other than the certainty that both of the bills will go through Ways and Means, which will get a fiscal analysis, that neither of the bills may, there's no guarantee that either of the bills will have any further analysis by policy committees.
I don't know what else to say.
I just want to be clear, that's what you're saying.
Well, what I'm saying is I know it's going to go to Ways and Means from here. It's going to go to the, if it comes out of Ways and Means, the first chamber it would go to would be stay here in the Senate. And once it gets to the House, that's a question for the Speaker.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one other element to my answer to Senator Witzig's question about the treatment grants, I just want to make the record very clear that these dollars under the Dash 8 go to the following purposes: Department of Corrections in-custody treatment programs, county jail beds, county treatment programs in the community or in local jails, county intensive supervision programs, and drug courts among Oregon's counties. The implementing language that I referenced in House Bill 3638 with the advisory committee set up, what we did, the intent behind that, and I think what the language accomplishes, was to craft a way to retain the local control aspect of Oregon's Community Corrections Act so that counties who are in the best position to let the state know how it can best use the supplemental dollars that would be flowing to them under this act would be able to target those dollars to one of those or multiple of those intended purposes.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question.
Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Leary, the last statement that you made, that these dollars would be targeted, so I'm assuming there will be some accountability in the grants. You can't just give them the money and hope that they use it for these programs, correct?
Chair Przanski, Senator Walker, that's absolutely correct. And in Section 8, page 10 of the bill, I would cite you to at least two levels of accountability. One is legislative accountability that's referenced in page 10, line 7, subsection 3A, the appropriate legislative committee shall periodically conduct oversight. And the second layer is on line 9, 3B, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission shall periodically conduct independent evaluations of these programs for their effectiveness in reducing criminal behavior in a cost-effective manner.
Perfect.
This is the second layer. It is all about making sure that these dollars are targeted to reduce victimization and reduce criminal activity.
Okay. And my final question for you, Mr. O'Leary, Mr. Chair, if I might. I'm anticipating that in the governor's recommended budget for 2009, we will see the appropriate dollar amounts listed in here.
Chair Przanski, Senator Walker, the governor and I had a conversation about that very point, and he is committed to doing that.
And, of course, the legislature can always ignore that, but we are hoping the legislature does not.
Chair Przanski, Senator Walker, agreed.
Good answer. All right, thank you.
All right, any other questions for these gentlemen?
Thank you very much.
Mr. Doyle, I understand you'd like to maybe make a few statements regarding treatment. Please come on up forward.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Steve Dole with Crime Victims United of Oregon. I want to first start out by saying that the reason that I can't tell you where Crime Victims United is because this is so new. I've got to talk to our board. We're not saying that we don't support this, but I can't tell you tonight that we do support this. So I want to make clear on where we're at with Crime Victims United. I also want to thank the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We've been working on this with them, I think, since last session finished and very intensely for the last approximately 90 days. And I thank them for all their work. I do want to thank Mr. Mannix, because we wouldn't be here discussing this problem today without him putting a marker down with his initiative. Property crimes are a plague on our neighborhoods. They're a plague on our communities, and they affect everyone's lives. We're looking at spending $40 million, as you said, Chair Przanski, on treatment. Crime Victims United is not and has never been against treatment. Obviously, treatment that leads to people not becoming recidivists, is a good thing for all of us. Here's what we're concerned with, though, and I want to start the conversation here today and hopefully continue the conversation. If we're going to spend $40 million, we've got to make sure that that expenditure is working. And I've handed out to you tonight a couple of articles. One is Reinventing Criminal Justice, and it's by a fellow by the name of Dr. Farabee, David Farabee. And Dr. Farabee is a research psychologist at UCLA, and he authored Rethinking Rehabilitation, Why Can't We Reform Our Criminals? And I think a key phrase in this article, and again, I'll ask you all to read it, but is this, that unfortunately the reality is that most of the state and federally funded interventions in use had never been evaluated, and the few rigorous assessments that have been published in journals of psychology and criminology show that these traditional rehabilitation programs have no lasting effect. Now, I know we have Senate Bill 267 in this state, and we're one of the only states that have codified research-based evidence, but the problem is not that we have it. It's where we land up on the scale that evaluates these programs. And right now we're dealing on that scale, in the lower end of the scale, and we need to get to the higher end of the scale. The second piece I'd ask you to all look at is a paper called, it's from the Academy of Experimental Criminology, Advancing Randomized Trials in Crime and Justice. And this gets exactly to the point that until we use rigorous evaluation that uses randomized studies, we're never going to know if these treatment modules are working or not. And in that report, you'll find an excerpt that says the following. Some scholars have argued that the differences between well-designed non-randomized studies and randomized experiments are not large. However, a review of a large number of criminal justice evaluations suggests that non-randomized studies are likely to systematically overestimate program success. So all I would ask you to do, and I know that Mr. Prinz and I have had numerous discussions on this, and he may disagree on this and say we can't use randomized studies, and I know we've had the same discussions with Dr. Bilotti over at the Department of Corrections. But this group suggests that we can, and that, in fact, they are doing it. And if we're going to be the best, then I think we ought to take this into consideration. And I appreciate you giving me the chance to have a few words.
Okay, thank you. I just want to put on the record, regarding that $40 million that is to set aside, it does include a major component of treatment. But within that treatment component are the jail beds, as well as drug courts and intensive supervision, which seems to be that holistic approach to make certain you have control of that individual and actually are able to monitor them through this whole program plus the treatment. So it's not just exclusively that. Hopefully we've built in enough from the local corrections partners, knowing what they need and giving them the flexibility. But I agree with you. There's no reason for this state to be spending money on programs that have not been successful. And we're just wasting our time, money, and efforts if that's what we're doing. And so hopefully we have the needs covered that you've raised, and the ability to make certain that these programs are going to be effective and cost-efficient. So thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Pruszynski. The question would be, not sort of pragmatically, how would a randomized study be produced in Oregon when under this bill treatment of all medium and high-risk addictions are mandated?
Well, I don't know that I can give you a direct answer to that. I know this, that again, there are places where it's being done. I think that without randomized selection, I think you only have to look at the pharmaceutical companies, mm-hmm. and ask yourself, would you be comfortable in taking the drugs that they're prescribing without having randomized tests on those drugs? Are we comfortable without selecting prisoners randomly to run the test to see how successful we're being with these treatment modalities?
The question was, wouldn't the wording of this bill prevent randomized selection?
Well, I don't know that it prevents it, but it certainly doesn't articulate it. In other words, by not using the language that we want to, I'm sorry for misunderstanding, Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt. I think without using the words randomized testing or random selection, that we're not getting there. And we, I think there were some discussions. I wasn't at the meeting, but I think there were some discussions on that. And at this point, those words had been left out. But I think without the words rigorous evaluation and random selection, there's nothing that prohibits that. But we're not asking for it in the bill.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Dole, actually, I think I'd probably like Mr. Prinz to come up and talk about the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission in the section in here. And I'd just ask Mr. O'Leary about, are we getting value for our dollar? Are we just throwing the money out there? And on page 10 in sub 3A and B, it indicates there's oversight. So maybe Mr. Prinz could tell us what oversight is included in the independent evaluations of the programs that the Criminal Justice Commission is doing, and maybe that will answer your questions here, Mr. Dole. I'm not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Walker. I'm Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. The issue that Steve's raising and that you're talking about is really how we design the evaluation. Mm-hmm. So I think that the answer is, one, an independent evaluation is always important to make sure it's unbiased. And that's that language, I believe. I don't think, Mr. Dole, I have the... Oh, wait a second. I did bring it up, Steve. I've got it right here.
Page 10.
That is in the bill. And the issue is, that Mr. Dole mentioned, trying to do a random assignment with human subjects is difficult. I think that so that's just want to make it that we can do what we're laying out here, and so what we've looked at is there's different type of experimental designs. You have to go before a IRB, which is a review board, to actually get the permission to do this type of evaluations of human subjects, and that's what we're going to work on and make sure that what we're doing is high-quality research. So I hope that answers your question, Senator. And we've used meta-analysis, which is there's many studies been done across the country. We want to rely on all of those, have the doctors look at all of those, rate the quality of those evaluations, and use all of that science as best we can. And that's what we've tried to set up, and what we've I think Oregon has been a pioneer on. So trying to rely on all of that good science, acknowledging that we have to make a determination of which things are rigorous enough and which are not.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Prinz, if I'm correct, what we use in 267 is evidence-based practices, mm-hmm. where we look at other programs that may very well have undergone a randomized test. And if I remember with the Washington State Policy Institute, when they evaluate programs, they use evidence-based practices. And what they will do when they go through it is if it's a randomized study, they rate it higher than they would another study that may not be randomized, may be different. And that's how they compare programs. Is that the similar process that you expect to use when you evaluate these programs?
Mr. Chair, Council Taylor, that's correct. Mr. Dole and I both looked at, there's a paper by the University of Maryland that's been around for probably over a decade that ranks the rigor of different evaluations. We like to look at, when we do this, we would drop the least rigorous and not rely on those because they don't have a good solid comparison group. Really, the issue, I think that, so yes, we would want to only rely on those that raise to the higher levels. And it's just, to me, it's a pragmatic thing of can we do it? And Steve and I have talked about that, and we've listened to Dr. Farabee, we've listened to Dr. Latessa, and we just want to make sure we can do what's in the bill, so.
And I believe, Mr. Chair and Mr. Dole, that the legislative oversight also is appropriate and I think meets your needs, because we have oversight over the Criminal Justice Commission in terms of how they are analyzing these programs and using these programs to assess their cost effectiveness. So, and you have an opportunity to be heard in the legislature, correct?
Correct. Okay. I think the question, Chair Brzezinski, Senator Walker, for us is if we took all our programs and laid them out on the Maryland scale, and it's not a complicated scale, it goes from 1 to 5, where do most of our programs land? And that's the question. I don't know if we have the answer to that at this point. I've been told by many people a lot of them are still landing in the 2-3 area. Even Dr. Bilotti himself has said that. And I think until we get to 4-5, and that's my real point here, that we're not doing what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that we're not wisely spending our money unless we get up in that area. I've heard politicians just in the last week come up in front of this microphone and say, we know treatment works. Believe me, I wish all treatment worked. I really do. But when I look at some of the results that I read, it frightens me. I wish we had the silver bullet. Boy, if I had that today, I'd walk out of here a happy camper.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case. And this mantra that everybody's singing, we know treatment works, I don't know who they think they're kidding. We don't.
Well, Mr. Doyle, wouldn't you agree that treatment does work if it's the right treatment and if it has been tested?
Absolutely.
So wouldn't make the statement that treatment doesn't work. It has to be one that's been tested and verified.
Right.
But treatment does work if it is effective.
If it's effective. But how much of that we're using is that's effective, and how much... And what the results of that are from on a percentage standpoint is the question.
And that's what I think we'll be doing over the next course in the next couple of years with this coming up. And with your input, hopefully we'll reach that.
Great.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Actually, I would address a similar question to Mr. Prince. If the Department of Corrections shall provide appropriate treatment to all drug-addicted persons in custody, can you tell me how you would fashion a randomized study?
Mr. Chair, so I understand your question is, what are you going to use for a control group?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to look at that and see what we can do. I understand your question. I don't know how we're going to do that. So we're moving so fast on this. The other thing I was going to say, the Criminal Justice Commission is also moving from lawyers like myself only, and we just recently got two PhDs that are on the commission. We're all moving, I think, in the right direction to making sure we understand what these programs are and we understand how to evaluate them. So I will get an answer for you. I will talk to Dr. Bilotti. I honestly don't even think that we've shared this language with him and see how we could do that.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I think the last panel we have will be Kevin Campbell and John Powell.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. It's a little bit of pressure to close out the hearing tonight. So on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, we want to support the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 1087. I've represented the Chiefs of Police as their executive director now, going on the 13th year, and so I've had a chance to see a number of these issues come and go that are of great significance to the public safety community. I want to mention three reasons that we're very supportive of the measure as it's now been developed in the Dash 8s. I want to mention, too, that within the last month, I've been a victim of property crimes. Just a block away from here in the McDonald's parking lot across from the state police building on a busy lunch day in their parking lot. Had my car broken into, my suitcase stolen. And as a result, I also took advantage of the bill you passed during the 2007 legislative session that allows me to put a security freeze on my credit reports. So I did that as a result.
Kevin. Our staff is asking that I have you identify yourself. I thought you did.
Yeah, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. Thank you. So, as a victim and as an Executive Director of the Chiefs of Police Association, let me tell you three reasons why we support the bill. First of all, we do believe that it meaningfully addresses the repeat property crime problem. Second of all, it does make a targeted investment in treatment, which to our association is very important, and I would concur with those who have said that our treatment practices need to be evidence-based, and we do need to do a good job of ensuring that it's not money that's put after programs that are not effective. I trust and believe, based on the language of the bill, the heart of the legislature, and the interest in the Department of Corrections to provide the kind of treatment that makes a difference, that I believe those things will occur, and I have complete confidence in that. I also believe that funding for drug court programs that we see throughout the state as being very effective are always good investments, and the chiefs of police fully support the investment in treatment that results in a reduction of recidivism and a return of people to more productive lives. The third thing I want to mention is not obvious in this discussion, but it's very important to the chiefs of police in the state, who just a few sessions ago found that if the public safety system isn't balanced in its funding, that the whole system can come apart. And the example I want to use is the funding crisis we had surrounding the Forensic Services Division, a time at which, because of the lack of funding there, the kind of the critical connection between arrest and prosecution was cut off, and the system simply didn't work. And the legislature came in, made adjustments, restored balance to the system. I believe that this proposal, because it is a targeted proposal financially, I think it's a smart investment, will help protect the overall system from seeing cuts that are unintended right now in the Initiative Petition 40 option. I look at, from the chiefs of police perspective, important funding priorities like our public safety training, state police funding, and other important public safety funding prospects for our public safety system, and I see that this proposal helps address the repeat property offender problem, and it also protects our ability to fund a public safety system that's balanced. And for that reason, the police chiefs will be supporting the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 1087.
Thank you.
Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Raul Ramirez, who has been more active in this than I, it was at the DPSST and some important meetings. I saw in the 5 o'clock news they were still at work there, so he's unable to be here with us this evening. I can say, Mr. Chair and members, that the Sheriff's Association totally supports the process that's brought you this bill. It's been open. We've been able to participate and give input. It's similar. Well, I've never been at a shotgun wedding or was never threatened by a father to marry his daughter. This is a little bit like that, I think, in that I know you have to act within the next 5 hours, and I'm not going to ask you to stay here any longer than you already have. Having said support for the process, the system that has the bill this far, I can say that I do believe the sheriffs will want to look at the funding proposal and the total package. As you know, 1145 funding caused a lot of consternation. Some sheriffs administer the community corrections program in their community. In other communities, there's a community corrections manager that does that. But overall, it has been a difficult walk with the partnership with the state. And again, that's not a criticism. We know resources are tight. How this may exacerbate that problem is something we'll look at. The message I want to give to you and the committee tonight is we'll be constructive partners going forward in this process.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah. Thank you. The question I have boils down to the difference for me between the Mannix proposal and this proposal. The Mannix proposal, one strike and you go to jail, and on this proposal it's two strikes or more, or two strikes. And the question I have, especially on somebody on meth,
I have a hard time with this. I really do. I think if somebody breaks into your car or your house, even if it's the first time, and especially if they're on meth, and which, from my knowledge, and I only claim from my knowledge, is treatment's not going to do them squat. I mean, they have to be incarcerated for 18 months to get the dopamine levels down to where they should be. So I see good things in the Mannix bill. I see good things in this bill, and they're kind of dueling bills, and that's where my problem lies, and I'm trying to find out why you think that the Mannix bill, other than the cost, if we take that aside, what else is there in the Mannix bill that you just can't live with?
Chair Brzezinski, Representative Girod, in answer to your question, first of all, I believe that the property crime consequences in this proposal would also allow the time necessary for people that are meth addicts to actually be addressed on a drug treatment side. But this is the proposal that has a drug treatment element to it. The Mannix proposal, to my knowledge, not on its own, does not address drug treatment. And I believe that is an important piece as we look at what we're seeing on the streets from a law enforcement perspective. Well, we want to make sure that treatment options are effective. The lack of treatment will not basically correct a meth addict's problem as they're released back, I don't believe, without the treatment. So, and I might add, Representative Girod, that there are no guarantees as it regards to meth either. That is a very troublesome drug, and I serve on the governor's meth task force and have for the last several years, and understand that it's extremely difficult drug for people to kick, even with proper treatment. The fact is, though, without treatment, they're very unlikely to return to a more productive life once they're out of prison.
Any other questions, comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Is there any other discussion? If not, then Senator Walker, I'm going to ask for a motion on the Dash 8.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 1087.
Senator Walker moves the Dash 8 amendments into Senate Bill 1087. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Roddick.
Thank you. I just held off now because I think it's disruptive to have people on the phone intervening, but I just wanted to commend you and the other members of this work group for really taking sound here and making a self-purge out of it. The Mannix Amendment, it's going to address the problem that's very real, was a budgetary train wreck, and it was also something that was guaranteed to be ineffective because there's lack of treatment dollars, so we can't incarcerate our way out of this problem. And I really commend you and the other members of your work group for coming up with something that really will make a difference for Oregonians and will be a wonderful addition to the progress that we made in 2005 on the meth work group. It's really the next step to deal with the downstream meth users, meth dealers, other drug dealers, property crimes, which are also drug related. And I think this will be a very positive thing for the state of Oregon. And I will have to say, I'm
still
surprised that you were able to get something out of that measure that I can
wholeheartedly
support. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. So is there any objection to the adoption of the Dash 8s? And Senator Burdick, I'm assuming you're in favor of those, just to put that on the record since you are not here?
That would be correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Those are adopted into the bill. And then, Senator Walker, we need a motion to send the amendment bill to Ways and Means. Hopefully with a DPAS recommendation.
All right. I would move Senate Bill 1087 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a DPAS recommendation.
And for this one, I'm going to ask the clerk to go ahead and call the roll.
Can I offer discussion here?
Oh.
Yeah. I'm going to vote no on this, and that's a very difficult vote for me, especially getting dropped into this situation. But we did have $2.7 billion of additional revenue in the last forecast that we spent. And I think that if you're on meth and you break into my house and you get caught, you should go to jail. Now, we've just passed something out for if somebody attends a dog fight, they get 5 years and $125,000, up to 5 years and $125,000 fine.
I see a big contrast to that, and it really bothers me, especially with meth addicts. And the one thing about this bill in particular, it treats meth addicts, heroin addicts, cocaine addicts, and ecstasy addicts as the same. And I see a large difference because the addiction is quite different. And so I think it's important not to have dueling ballot measures, and I think Kevin Mannix deserves to be applauded because we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for his bill. And so I will be voting no on this, but I'm hoping that when it goes over to the House side that we can get Kevin Mannix back on board and we can kind of work through some of these problems so that we can have something that I think everybody can support and that we don't have dueling ballot measures that go out to the public.
All right. Thank you for your comments. Senator Wissett.
Thank you. I will also be voting no today, reluctantly. As I said from the beginning, I have difficulty supporting Senate Bill 1087 if it turned out to be referred to the people in a dueling ballot measure, as you pointed out. I think that, frankly, the likelihood of this referral being successful against IP40 is pretty slim, and so I don't think we've accomplished anything unless we get the other player on board. I'm also concerned. I mentioned the other significant concern is the language of the current draft that requires treatment. I think that's a mistake. I think that it should be up to the discretion of the professionals to decide who's appropriate to be done. I will have another bite at this in Ways and Means, and another bite at it in the Senate. So today I'm going to vote no.
All right. Thank you. I'll just put on the record myself, I disagree with Senator Wissett as to his interpretation that this requires treatment. The language to me is written in a sense that it will, in fact, require the risk assessment that are done, and that there will be a prioritization of those who are, let's say, best suited and to receive the treatment. Hopefully, as we've heard, it will be treatment that is cost-effective and effective in returning the results of breaking the recidivism. Regarding the situation of trying to get everyone on board, you know, that's one of those things that we try to do as much as we can. At the reality, though, we believe we have, I believe that the work group has put together a more balanced approach, one that does, in fact, have treatment built into it. And based on the evidence I've seen, that is a key component, and it is a situation that the IP40 does not have. And we also, I believe that most of the people in this state believe in what we call the carrot and stick. They're going to demand that these individuals be held accountable for their crime at the same time that we're going to give them the opportunity for those who are meet the risk assessment to get the drug treatment, and if they refuse it or fail to do it, they will be sanctioned for that. And so that is the incentive. Hopefully that will give them a reason to reflect, and hopefully giving them also the opportunity through an effective program to be successful in breaking these ties that they have. As a prosecutor for 20 years, I can tell you that I'd rather see these people actually back in their community, providing, let's say, tax dollars to us and being part of the community and service, as compared to being a recipient of those tax dollars in the criminal justice system or in the human services, realizing at the same time for those who are not going to comply and conform their behavior to the standards of this community, that they should in fact be sanctioned with jail or prison sanctions, as well as other sanctions that would be appropriate. So any other statements? Mm-hmm. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it would be irresponsible of this legislature if we did not provide an alternative to IP40 that is likely to qualify for the ballot. So dueling ballot measures is fine with me, because I think IP40 is not what will suit our state in terms of solving the issues and being a balanced approach and actually resolving the problems in a more cost-effective manner. I think this legislature has done its job. You've done yeoman's work, Mr. Chair, at the helm, And this is an incredible opportunity for Oregon to change the way that we incarcerate individuals, offer treatment, and change the way we're actually looking at our criminal justice system. I think states all over the country are looking at different ways to work with our criminal justice system to make it be more cost-effective, to make it use effective treatment programs. We talked a lot about that today. I don't think there's anything in this bill that says that anyone has to have treatment. There will be the risk assessment, as you've indicated. And, in fact, some people who need treatment probably won't get it because they will be determined to be of low risk of reoffending. Yet I believe they could probably benefit from treatment. I think we've provided as much balance in here and protections in here for Oregonians, and certainly a much more well-crafted measure than what we would see in IP 40. So doing ballot measures it is, and hopefully the citizens of Oregon will be able to see the differences between the two and vote accordingly. And I do understand, Mr. Chair, with the amendment in the bill, Section 14 certainly says that either bill will work. Section 13 and Section 14 address whether which ballot measure passes, which one goes into effect. I assume that's all constitutional to allow that sort of provision. And so if it is, then I'm on board, and I think this legislature should be proud of its work.
Thank you. Senator Burdick, do you have any closing comments before we take the vote? All right, thank you. If we can go ahead and call the roll on this vote, please.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Ross?
No.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitson?
No.
Chair Pazan?
Aye. The motion passes, and I believe that's going to take care of the work. Mr. Taylor, is there anything else we need to do?
Mr. Chairman, is the committee not tonight?
All right, so we're going to close our committee for tonight. I want to thank everyone who's been here most of the day, that we had to make certain that we had all the drafting completed. And lastly, I do want to thank the Legislative Council. Josh is in the room before you walk out. Thank you very much for being able to dedicate your time today to help us complete the work on the Dash 8s.
All weekend, too.
And all weekend, too, that's for sure. And thank you very much, and we're adjourned for the evening.